Welcome to EmergencyMedicineCases.com. I'm your host, Dr. Anton Hellman, bringing you Canada's brightest minds in emergency medicine from EMC Studios in Toronto. First off, in our highlights of the Emergency Medicine Update Conference 2014, we have with us Dr. Stuart Swadron. Dr. Swadron is the Vice Chair for Education and the Residency Program Director in the Department of Emergency Medicine at LA County USC Medical Center. He's an Associate Professor of Clinical Emergency Medicine at USC's Keck School of Medicine of the University.
All right, so we're going to talk about something scary, right? Vertigo. Now, the whole thing about vertigo is we're concerned about missing a stroke, and those strokes obviously are in the brainstem, okay? Probably about less than 25% of the brain is the area where all the important stuff is in terms of the cranial nerves that we're talking about. And so that works to our advantage, of course, because it's very hard to get a central 8 nerve without getting other things in the neighborhood. It's very hard to get an 8 without getting something around it. Okay? Now, is it isolated is the question here. If it's isolated vertigo, it's much less likely to be something serious. Okay? So everyone knows that. Now, if you have more than one thing on the central side, you're automatically talking about central vertigo, MRI, admit, that type of stuff. The other side, the peripheral vertigo, the only time when you actually can make a diagnosis of peripheral vertigo when you have more than one feature, okay, is this, when you have vertigo, tinnitus, and hearing loss. What's that? That's Meniere's disease, right? So outside of that, if vertigo is not isolated, okay, then forget it, right? It's beyond us. It's going to be something we're going to have to consult for. We're going to get an MRI, that type of thing, okay? And there's something interesting that's happened in the past couple of years, actually, is we used to say, if they've got the vertigo and the hearing loss together, that's peripheral. Unbelievably, in the past 3 years, several articles have come out that have actually debunked that. So outside of the actual Meniere's triad of tinnitus and vertigo and hearing loss, if it's not isolated, it's central until proven otherwise. A lot of people miss strokes. It's very hard to practice with never missing a posterior fossa stroke in your whole career, okay? But if you look back at the charts, you see the same old crap every time. Cranial nerves, 2 through 12, normal, okay? You can't write stuff like that because people say, well, did you test cranial nerve number 7? How did you do it? Did you look at the anterior 2/3 of the tongue taste and all that kind of stuff? I just actually tell my residents to write down no Ds. Okay, and those basically, the diplopia, the dysarthria, those are basically the other neighborhood signs. Those are the other cranial nerves. So at a minimum, you want to make sure that you document if that was what you were worried about. If someone comes in with that vertigo and you're worried about making sure it's not a stroke, you've got to at least document that they don't have any other Ds other than the dizziness, the vertigo.
Just to remind our listeners, the 5 Ds of a posterior circulation stroke are dizziness, diplopia, dysarthria, dysphagia, and dysmetria, or cerebellar ataxia.
And it's also important to check the long tracts because they all go through that neighborhood too. And the most important thing to check that can give you a heads up is just a plantar response, and no one ever does it. And don't do it in the States anymore. No one does that kind of stuff. They test motor strength, and that's it. But if you get an upgoing plantar, you're done. It's central, right? And so that's an important thing to add on to your routine.
So the clincher when it comes to vertigo is first to figure out if the vertigo is isolated or not, because that'll help lead you towards a central versus a peripheral cause. If the vertigo is truly isolated, we don't worry so much about the nasty possibility of a posterior circulation stroke. Remember that the cerebellum and brainstem are both supplied by the basilar artery and are much smaller than the cerebral hemispheres, and so it's hard for a stroke to pick off the vestibulo-ocular nerve, that's cranial nerve number 8, without picking off other cranial nerves. To help you remember which signs to look out for with these other cranial nerves, think of the 5 Ds. Again, dizziness, diplopia, dysarthria, dysphagia, and dysmetria. And don't forget to check the long tracts as well in the extremities. Next, Dr. Swadron is going to talk about the importance of getting that vertiginous patient up off the bed and doing a walk test to help give you more data to work with in deciding whether the patient has a central or peripheral cause of their vertigo.
So it's very important to walk your patients, right? And everyone's heard that a million times. And it's very true that all this diadoco stuff and this pointing stuff is not that helpful. And I'm sure that you know that. But when you get them up to walk, you'll see that there's a problem often if they've got a cerebellar involvement, okay? Now, I know what a lot of you are probably thinking. When I get my patients up with BPPV, with benign positional paroxysmal vertigo, to walk, they don't walk so hot. And I don't know what the hell these guys are talking about all the time when they say walk the patient. And I want to make sure that you understand the contrast between how people walk when they've got BPPV, which is the commonest cause of benign vertigo, and when they've actually had a cerebellar stroke. So what do you walk like when you have BPPV, right? Someone says, get up and walk. What do you think they look like? You know, I mean, they're really sick and they're miserable and they're vomiting and you guys know, right? And they're kind of holding on to something and they walk a little bit and they go, and then they walk a little bit more and they go, you know, it's a very miserable thing, right? So residents, when they're beginning, always say, well, this guy has a problem walking. He doesn't look like he's that steady. And you know that's the case, right? But the difference is that when people have a cerebellar lesion, okay, and the cerebellum is a big place, it's a bonus. If you see that there's a cerebellar sign, you know you're done. You know that there's a central infarct. And so the thing about cerebellar strokes, and we've had the privilege to have a few emergency doctors that were unfortunate enough to have suffered cerebellar strokes, and they tell you what the difference is. When they tell them to walk, they said, geez, you know, and I have a friend that was one of these people. He's 50 years old. He had a posterior cerebellar stroke. And he said, you know, they told me to walk. I didn't know the difference between the floor and the ceiling. It wasn't even an issue of walking. I mean, it was just forget about it, okay? And that's the kind of thing that you might hear. And the reason for that is that, just to do a schematic, remember that the cerebellum is the master mover. No movement happens without going through the cerebellum. It's got its inputs from the eyes and from the vestibular glands and from the spinal cord, right? And so those are the three inputs, and the cerebellum is the master mover that coordinates them all. So if you have a problem with your vestibular gland, you've got a virus that's causing an acute vestibular syndrome, the brain is smart enough to shut that off. The cerebellum will forget about that input, and it will just use the other inputs. That's the important difference between a cerebellar central lesion and these peripheral lesions, okay? When you have a problem with the cerebellum itself, it doesn't matter what the eyes see, it doesn't matter what the vestibular glands say, it doesn't matter what the spinal cord says, you just cannot coordinate your movement. And so there's a fundamental difference. And the very, very important thing to grasp is that missed stroke, when you look through the bad cases and the closed claims, you see the same thing. You see young women that came in, their exam showed that they had non-isolated vertigo, i.e. they had more than one D, but the doc, because they just, you know, they were young and they didn't have, in their opinion, a lot of risk factors, they just dismissed it. And so it's critical to go with that exam that we just talked about, your exam with the Ds and the long tracks, and go with it. And that's exactly the kind of patients that we see in the literature we're missing these strokes on. In fact, there was just a big New York Times article about it.
So for young patients who present with vertigo, look for the Ds, look for the long tracks, ask about risk factors. For example, if they smoke or if they're on the birth control pill or they use cocaine or they have autoimmune disease, they're at higher risk for stroke than the general population. Because the patients that we miss stroke on most often are young patients. Next, Dr. Swadron is going to talk about the use of CT in patients who present with vertigo.
So we had a little discussion, Mike and I, about CT and whether I do CT. And I absolutely do CT on patients that are older with lots of risk factors because you often will see evidence of vascular disease there. The other issue, of course, is that you'll see bleeds. And, you know, we were talking about if I'm really confident it's BPPV, then I won't do it. Well, you know what? No one can be that confident of anything. Studies of neurologists over the past 10 years have found that even they will get it wrong in terms of distinguishing central and peripheral vertigo. So if patients are older, I tend to do a CT to check for bleeding. Now, I'm not doing a CT to look for a brainstem infarct. I'm doing a CT to look for the mass effect of a cerebellar infarct. Yes, it's true you might not see an infarct in the posterior fossa on CT technology. It's possible. The thing is that when the serious part about that is that it swells and you herniate, you get tonsillar herniation. And so you might not be able to detect that there's hypodensity, but look at the fourth ventricle. It's been squeezed and deformed. And so one thing I think ER doctors should be pretty consistently looking for on the CTs is to see whether or not there's any deformity of the fourth ventricle. So you see that, and what do? You call a neurosurgeon, right? Because that patient's going to herniate. They spend so much time in medical school telling us to worry about cerebellar bleeds. But the fact of the matter is it more common and more life-threatening is an infarct because it's going to cause swelling and it's going to kill them. And people don't recognize it on the CT. They don't look for it. So that's important.
In the blog post and written summary, we'll have an image of a CT head showing a cerebellar stroke with a squashed fourth ventricle.
Okay, so what we've covered so far is making sure that it's isolated. And that's the most important thing. And if you just do that, and you just stick to your guns and make sure that the vertigo is isolated and there's no other Ds, you're doing a pretty good job. And just to see how good a job we're doing, there was an article that came out. It's not that important about the methodology, but this is all the California hospitals and everyone discharged for vertigo or for dizziness, okay? And of those patients, only 1 in 500 did they find that there was a stroke in the first month after discharge. That's the first thing I need to do is to reassure you because people are so paranoid about missing posterior strokes, and it's a really big issue now. But if you compare it to the number of missed MIs or acute coronary syndromes, what's the miss rate for an acute coronary syndrome? 2%, 3%, 4%, right? So the miss rate for this is a lot lower, and so that should provide some relief. Now, if you want to be even better than that, though, there's still room for improvement. Even in this study, they were able to show that in that first month there, you see that big hump? There was an excess of cerebrovascular death. So we were losing patients from strokes in that first month after they were discharged. So there still is an opportunity to do better. And so the last thing I'm going to discuss with you is how to be so good that when someone comes in with isolated vertigo, that you'll still be able to pick the few strokes out of that. The first thing and the most common thing, maybe 90% of these cases, are BPPV, okay? And the key to making the diagnosis of BPPV is the time course, okay? They have episodes of vertigo that are limited to less than 1 minute. And you're probably thinking, that's BS, because these people are dizzy and miserable all the time. They get up to walk, they're not steady, right? You're thinking that. But if you actually talk to the patients when you're moving them, they'll tell you that they have vertigo. Forget about the Dix-Hallpike for a second. And that sensation of movement will only last for a few seconds. They're going to feel like crap forever. They're going to feel like crap after that. They might vomit after that. But the actual sensation of spinning is only limited to several seconds, okay, less than a minute. And that's the key to making this diagnosis. And then you know the treatment is the Epley maneuver, and I didn't believe in that either when it came out, but if you have the patients repeat it over and over at home, it actually works. It's near 100%. Now, yesterday I was talking about the path to hell being paved with D-dimers and BNP. Actually, I have a new version of that. The path to hell is actually when you go through the... They're not pearly gates. What are they? Red gates? When you go through, you basically see people performing this maneuver on either side of you, the Dix-Hallpike maneuver. And the reason I say that is every lawsuit that I've been referred of a missed posterior fossa stroke, they've all shared one thing in common. They all have a designation positive Dix-Hallpike. So my recommendation is to stop doing this test, okay? Because it's basically not understood well, and it's basically leading people down the path to misdiagnosing posterior fossa strokes.
Whoa there, Dr. Swadron. I have to stop him here because I believe that the Dix-Hallpike, if understood and performed properly and interpreted properly, is a valuable test. And the key is if understood and performed properly. Just like any test in medicine, if it's not understood and used properly, it can lead you down the wrong path. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. Dr. Swadron goes on to tell you how to understand, perform, and interpret the Dix-Hallpike properly in a minute. But first, I'd like to tell you about some of the available literature on the accuracy of the Dix-Hallpike maneuver for the diagnosis of benign positional vertigo. According to the clinical practice guideline on BPPV, put out by the Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery Journal in 2008, and by the American Academy of Neurology in the same year, the Dix-Hallpike maneuver is considered the gold standard test for the diagnosis of BPPV. They note that the accuracy of the Dix-Hallpike maneuver for BPPV may differ between specialty and non-specialty clinicians, but that a sensitivity of 82% and a specificity of 71% for the Dix-Hallpike maneuver in BPPV has been reported for specialty clinicians, and in the primary care setting, a positive predictive value for a positive Dix-Hall-Pike test of 83% and a negative predictive value of 52% has been reported. So, a Dix-Hall-Pike maneuver doesn't necessarily rule in or rule out a diagnosis of BPV, but it can be helpful as one important data point in deciding whether or not a patient has BPPV or a posterior circulation stroke causing their vertigo. The problem with the Dix-Hall-Pike maneuver is that if you take a patient with a stroke and do the maneuver on them, they will have non-specific worsening of their symptoms, and if you misinterpret that as a positive Dix-Hall-Pike, that's when you run into trouble. It's all about interpreting the test carefully. It should only be considered positive when a patient without vertigo at rest has vertigo and torsional nystagmus beginning briefly after the sudden change in position and then resolves in under a minute. The nystagmus produced by the Dix-Hall-Pike maneuver in BPPV typically shows two important diagnostic characteristics. First, there's a latency period between the time that you put the patient's head down and the onset of subjective rotational vertigo and the objective nystagmus. A typical latency period would range from 5 to 20 seconds, although it may be as long as a minute in rare cases. Secondly, the nystagmus has a crescendo-decrescendo pattern. That is, the rate of nystagmus typically begins gently, increases in intensity, and then declines in intensity as it resolves over about 1 minute. Another classical feature of the nystagmus associated with BPPV is that the nystagmus typically fatigues. That is, there's a reduction in the severity of the nystagmus when the maneuver is repeated. But most experts don't recommend repeating the Dix-Hall-Pike because it's cruel punishment to the patient. Now Dr. Swadron will give you some tips on how to perform the Dix-Hall-Pike properly.
And if you're going to do this test, there's a certain thing you have to do. First of all, you don't do it on anyone who's vomiting or sick or looks like they're incapacitated. I mean, you do it on people who look okay, who have no nystagmus at rest, okay? If you want to do it, that's how you do it. And you've got to be looking at them the whole time you take them over. You have to be making eye contact. That alone is enough to invalidate the test if you don't do that properly. You take them over and you look at them. And what do you expect to see when you look at that person after you've bent them over the table? So what you expect to see, remember this, is nothing. You should see nothing. Nothing should happen. And several seconds should pass before you actually see the nystagmus. So the delayed onset has got to be there. And the other things about the Dix-Hall-Pike is that it's fatigable because the brain is smart enough to say, hey, I'm getting garbage messages from the vestibular glands. Shut them off. And if you ask the patient to fixate, it will immediately, you'll see within seconds that it will stop. Okay, it decreases with fixation, again, because of the cerebral control. So if you are going to do a Dix-Hall-Pike, do it properly, and maybe you won't be in trouble. Now, BPPV is definitely the biggest thing, and it's the easiest thing to knock off this list. The real difficulty, the real stress, comes from distinguishing acute vestibular syndromes and cerebellar strokes. And again, it's the onset that is key. Cerebellar strokes tend to have a more sudden onset, but you can still be fooled.
Now, this upcoming part is where the money is. Dr. Swadron is going to talk about the head impulse test, which is the first part of your mnemonic HINTS, H-I-N-T-S, head impulse, central nystagmus, and test of skew.
So this is the head impulse test. It's kind of like a doll's eyes. Very straightforward. When you move someone's head quickly to the side, you expect them to follow you, okay? And there should be a seamless movement of the eyes. So even though we're going to both sides, okay, quickly, her eyes, there's no saccadic movement. Her eyes seamlessly track you, okay? Normal is bad. This is confusing, but normal is bad. So say this woman, okay, you went through, and she's their young woman taking the birth control pill, and she smokes, and you're deciding whether she's got an acute vestibular syndrome or she's got a stroke, and you do that test, and it comes out like that. What does it mean? It means she's got a stroke. Because if she has a vestibular syndrome, you're going to see a positive on one side with saccadic movement. So when you move this gentleman's head to the left, there's no problem. He seamlessly tracks you. When you move it to the right, you can see that he has to do a catch-up movement. No problem towards the left. When he goes to the right, that jumping is indicating that he has a vestibular gland problem on the right side. So this is a benign situation. So you expect to see a positive head impulse test in patients that have acute vestibular syndrome, a benign peripheral acute vestibular syndrome, which you treat with steroids.
So let's go over this first part of the HINTS exam, the head impulse test. An abnormal result of a head impulse test usually indicates a peripheral vestibular lesion, whereas a normal response virtually confirms a stroke. This is how to perform the head impulse test. Ask the patient to stare directly at your nose, then quickly rotate the patient's head to one side and then the other. If you look at the patient's eyes carefully and see corrective saccades when turning to the given side, this is highly suggestive of a peripheral cause on that same side. A negative head impulse test, that is, normal eye movement without the jumping corrective saccade, should raise your suspicion for a cerebellar stroke. Now, rarely a patient with stroke will have an abnormal head impulse test, but this will also be accompanied by other focal neurologic findings, usually subtle oculomotor findings. So an abnormal head impulse test by itself does not completely rule out stroke. You need the rest of the HINTS exam and an otherwise perfectly normal neurologic exam to rule out stroke. So what makes up the rest of the HINTS exam? The N stands for central nystagmus, and the T stands for test of skew. The presence of any one of these three dangerous signs has a sensitivity of 100% and a specificity of 96% for stroke. Now that you've got the idea about the head impulse test, Dr. Swadron's going to talk about the rest of the HINTS exam. That is the N of central nystagmus and the T of test of skew.
So anything that's vertical is central. And by that same token, anything that's bidirectional is central. So if you have nystagmus that moves sometimes to the left and sometimes to the right, that's automatically central. And anything vertical is automatically central. Now, there's one last thing that I'll tell you about is skew. And vertical skew, where there's misalignment of the eyes in the vertical plane, is another important sign of central vertigo. And so that can be very obvious in a case like this. It's more likely to be subtle. And the way that you uncover it, this is not news to you, is by a cover-on-cover alternating covering test. And as you alternately cover each eye, this is a little bit tougher to see, but you'll see that there's a vertical misalignment of the eyes. You're done at central. Okay? So putting that all together, the patient can't have any signs of central nystagmus, which are bidirectional or vertical. They can't have any misalignment vertically of their eyes with the covering alternate cover test, okay? And the head impulse test, in order for it to be consistent with peripheral vertigo, has to be positive on one of the sides, okay? And if you put those all together, they are a new mnemonic called HINTS. And this has been promulgated mostly by a real great guy at Johns Hopkins named Dave Newman Toker. And he's not an emergency doctor, and he's contributed a tremendous amount to our specialty. This HINTS test, okay, get ready for this, is more sensitive than diffusion-weighted MRI for stroke. You heard that right. So there are several patients in these series who identify themselves as central vertigo by the HINTS test, and then the MRI is negative. And then a day later, the MRI turns positive. So this is incredibly important and sensitive stuff.
So at this point, I just want to review a few of the key pitfalls when it comes to vertigo. One of the key pitfalls when it comes to the signs and symptoms of peripheral versus central causes of vertigo has to do with hearing loss. Now, normally we think of a change of hearing associated with vertigo as ruling in a peripheral cause. However, an acute change in hearing accompanying vertigo does not rule out stroke because you can pick off the auditory cranial nerve along with the vestibular cranial nerve with a stroke. Another key pitfall, again, when incorporating the Dix-Hallpike into your decision-making, is that exacerbation of symptoms or signs with the Dix-Hallpike can occur in both peripheral and central vertigo. Now, one diagnosis that we haven't talked about that can present with acute vertigo is vertebral artery dissection. If a patient presents with acute vertigo and has a history of a recent headache or neck pain, or have headache and neck pain in the eMERGE, this should raise your suspicion for a vertebral artery dissection. Recent minor head or neck trauma is also an associated risk factor for vertebral artery dissection, but in many cases, there isn't an identifiable history of trauma. One last pitfall is assuming that a history of multiple transient prodromal episodes of dizziness over a few weeks or months rules out stroke. In fact, It's quite the opposite. A red flag for stroke includes a history of multiple transient prodromal episodes of dizziness over a few weeks or months. So again, headache, neck pain, or recent trauma associated with vertigo should make you think about vertebral artery dissection. If a patient has a change in hearing, don't assume this is peripheral. This could still be a stroke. And finally, if the patient has a history of multiple transient prodromal episodes of dizziness over weeks or months, this may represent TIAs and increases the chance that the patient presenting to your ED with vertigo has a stroke. Now, all this being said, what if you miss a cerebellar stroke? Well, one small series of misdiagnosed cerebellar stroke reported a 40% mortality as compared with a 5% mortality in the largest unselected series of patients with known cerebellar stroke. So this is a serious disease. Remember that in the posterior fossa, there's not much room for that edema to spread out. And that leads to raised intracranial pressure and bad outcomes. Dr. Swadjan's now going to wrap it up for us.
So what have we learned today? Make sure that it's isolated. And if you do that, you're a pretty good doctor. You're pretty good, and you won't miss many cases. But there still are some cases of isolated vertigo, and so you still have to consider those things, if it's isolated, the ABCs, and find it where it is. And I'm just going to review the algorithm from the beginning. So the patient's got dizziness, and you made sure that it's not disequilibrium, you made sure that it's not lightheadedness, you're sure that this is a sensation of movement. Is it isolated? Okay, I'm repeating myself for a reason. Is it isolated? If they've got any of these 5Ds, if they've got any long track signs, if there's any abnormalities on the CT, if you chose to do it, of course you're going to go do the MRI, call the neurologist, and admit the patient. If none of those things are present, you're still a pretty good doc. And just to remind you, the brief episodes, the temporal component is key to picking up BPPV. You don't have to do a Dix-Hallpike. Acute vestibular syndromes, although the onset is gradual and that usually distinguishes it, that head impulse test is an extra feature that you can use to reassure yourself that it's not central vertigo. And of course, abrupt onset with a negative head impulse test is more suggestive of a cerebellar stroke. So I've simplified things. I hope that's helpful for you. Thanks a lot.
And for this month's quote of the month, we have one from Albert Einstein. Everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. Before we go on to the next chapter of this episode, I just want to remind you to please put your comments and share your thoughts on the Emergency Medicine Cases website. Remember that one of the most valuable ways we can learn is by having a discussion. So I'd love to hear what you think about Dr. Swadjan's vertigo lecture.